Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. This is Podcast Mike and welcome to episode 11 of the Willosophy's compilation series. Wrapping it up now, there's one more after this, and today's theme again is What's Your Philosophy? Part 3. This is probably one of the main topics of the podcast that we hear discussed. It usually kicks off most of the conversation, and I think in a lot of the other episodes of the compilation series, a lot of the chats do center around philosophy anyway, but like, I guess this is a more focused version of that. Thank you so much for all the feedback we've been getting on the Twitter account. The Twitter is WillosophyPod, P-O-D. There's also an Instagram, WillosophyPod, P-O-D. You can go to tofop.com, T-O-F-O-P.com, if you want to hear any of the chats in full. The entire back catalogue of the podcast is there. There's heaps of episodes. I think there's over 70 episodes with over, 70 guests as well. So there's a lot of great content, which is the whole idea of this. But today, you will hear from Phil McDonald, who also happens to be Will's neighbour, which says a lot about the spectrum of guests that we get on this podcast. You will also hear from Lauren Freed. But first up for today, it's Kelly Carlin. Kelly is a writer, an actress, and producer, and radio host based in the USA. She is the daughter of the famous comedian George Carlin, which she talks about a little bit in this chat as well. And she speaks on her philosophy to be a seeker of knowledge and live in the moment. It's a really great chat. Will's comedy show at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival is on sale now. It's called Will Informed. Head to willanderson.com for tickets and more details. But for now, let's head over to hear from Kelly Carlin.
It's literally the reason I asked the question at the start of the podcast. Yeah. Is I like to see what people say, because I suspected when I started the podcast that everyone will always fill it in with, I guess, autobiographical information.
And a resume. Like, you feel like you have to, like, put your resume out there so that you have some sort of, I don't know, qualification to be someone who could talk into a microphone in a podcast.
I don't know. Did you watch the Republican debate the other night? Did you see any of that?
I watched a teeny little bit of it. I watched some of them and not all of them, you know.
So I'm a bit the same, because I only tend to catch them when I'm in America and I'm here when it's on. But I watched the other night, and somebody has obviously told Chris Christie that I believe he's the governor of New Jersey.
He is,
and,
yes.
They've obviously told him that he doesn't have enough recognition of the things that he's done or whatever. Right. So in every single answer, it was like really like it was mesmerizing to watch, because he would start every answer by like, so you'd ask something like, Mr. Christie, what do you think of ISIS? And he goes, well, I was on a government committee for 3 years between 1889 and 1943. And like, and he would just, but it would be at the top of every answer.
Yeah.
And he would just like, a little bit of information. Here's a little bit of my biography.
Here's my expertise.
Here's my IMDb.
Yes, totally.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to walk through all those things, but let's get to the question of the podcast. And then once we've got the premise out of the way, we can just get down.
We can talk about whatever we want.
We can just have the conversation. Right, yeah, you know. Cool. All right. So do you have a philosophy, Kelly Carlin?
You know, that's a good question.
Good. Thanks. Good. I'm just going to edit that into the promo.
I think I do. I'm pretty sure I do have a philosophy.
Okay. What is it?
You know, I mean, I was listening to your podcast and I heard you ask someone that question. I thought, wow, I got to think about this. And then yet it's like, I feel like everything I do in my life is about trying to talk about this philosophy. I mean, I guess the biggest thing, my biggest philosophy is that I'm a person who is always seeking more information about everything. For me, being a seeker, whether of knowledge or wisdom or experience, like that's, I don't know. I can't stop being a seeker. Like I want to be like, I've gotten to a point a couple of times in my life where I'm like, okay, I know enough. I know enough. I don't need to be seeking. I don't need to figure it all out. I don't need to fix anything. Like, I used to want to be fixing myself all the time. Like, that was my big life thing. It was like, I just need to, like, heal my wounds and fix myself, and then I'll be okay. And then I, like, realized, okay, that's exhausting, and maybe I'm just this wounded kind of semi-broken person. That's okay. I'm functioning. It's working out. And I'm not, like, horrifically anxious anymore. I had, like, panic attack disorder at one point. So, like, yeah, I needed to fix that. That's probably a good thing to fix. And I do reach points where I'm like, okay, I don't really need to, like, seek. I can just, like, know what I know. And I'm a little bit at that in my life right now. Like, because I, you know, I write about things. I talk about things. I have a perspective on things. So you got to, like, feel like you own something of knowledge when you want to say to the world, hey, this is the way I see it. But I'm never satisfied. I'm always like, okay, what's next?
All right. Firstly, I love it. Like, this is, you're totally on the same page as me when it comes to this sort of thing. There are so many things just already in that that I want to talk about. But the first one is that idea of, like, going from being like, you know, kind of a fixer to a seeker. And it's, I kind of think of it about, like, you know, it's always like you're building the foundations of your house or whatever, right? Now, if there is a problem, like, if you think of your life as, like, there's a problem, there's a hole there, you can just pave over the top of it.
Yeah, you can try for a little while.
But at some stage,
yes,
you're going to fucking walk and
you need to go in
gonna
and
be
do
a big
the work.
Storm and, like, you're going to fall through the floor if you don't do that, right?
Yeah.
But you also have got to think of your whole life as being like this foundation. So every day you've still built, even if you've identified a problem that you have to fix, that's about you building this foundation, and you have to take the good things, you know, as well, and keep adding to that foundation.
Yes.
You can't just worry about all the problems you have. You also have to keep building the house.
Yes, yes.
And I guess that's what, like, you know, if you want to extend that analogy a little bit further, is that idea of going, well, here's the thing. At the moment, we don't have time to, or the money or whatever, to fix that problem, but we need to keep building the house. Sometimes you need to keep building the house, right? And sometimes you need to fix the problems as well. You've got to, and I think that's that idea of, like, life being this thing of, rather than a bucket that you fill up and then you'll be like, feel like you've accomplished something, you know, rather it being this thing that you're constantly adding to, and and that it is infinite, because I think that so often we search for simplicity in our lives. You know, that's why we look at religions. That's why we look at rules. That's why Fight Club was appealing to
people. Any kind of ideology. It's like, just give me your rules.
Tell me.
And just tell me the rules, and I will live by those five things, and then I never have to think about it again.
Right.
But would be lovely.
It would be lovely.
would be.
I understand why that's appealing.
Yes, but not real.
Right.
It doesn't happen that way.
It doesn't happen. And if you know anything about, you know, what we know about the nature of the universe, the truth is, from a, like, from a scientific point of view, I guess, from a point of view of the universe, that everything we do, even when we're trying to make things more simple, by its very nature makes the universe exponentially more complicated.
Yes.
Literally the nature of existing. So rather than, like, you know, finding it paralyzing, you know, finding this idea that we are just part of an infinite journey onwards, and we're just a step on the ladder, you know, for someone else hopefully to stand on the shoulders of and move on to whatever it is next. It's like, it is a kind of a liberating thought.
It is. Yeah. I mean, when you take, I was just listening on the way here to a gentleman named James Hillman, who's the father of what they call archetypal psychology. I got my master's in Jungian psychology, and he's just, you know, he was talking about taking the humans out of the center of the universe, you know, that when we put ourselves in the center of things, and we make ourselves the most important thing, that tends to make the world look a very certain way and operate a very certain way. The way we're living it right now, right, by the way. And that when you really put yourself in the proper place in the universe, which is, we are just one of a multitude of things, it's very liberating. It's very freeing. But it doesn't take us off the hook in any way. It just takes the arrogance out of it, first of all, which I think is really important. But it does. It frees us to really be in true relationship with life, and our life in particular. You know, I mean, there's no such thing as perfection. I mean, that's another thing, like, that seeking, fixing ideology thing is a desperate wanting of something perfect that stays the same and fixes. But look at nature. Shit's moving all the time and changing in every second. And it is our discomfort with our imperfections and this constant change that creates anxiety and all of that, that makes us want to cling once again to ideologies and quick fixes and rules and religions and stuff.
Okay. So a couple of things on that. The first one, I want to put a pin in, but like, I want to get to how that reflects in, like, you know, contemporary politics and mm-hmm. the idea of conservatism, because I certainly think there is an element of you know, that in that thought of,
yes,
like, but the other thing is, like, I've been thinking about this quite a lot recently, is that idea of like perfectionism, which is like something that you mentioned there, this idea of things needing to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I would go a step further. And I think actually, like, you know, when someone says, or like when someone gets hung up on the idea of not being able to do something because they're a perfectionist.
Yes.
Like that's your own arrogance. Like, that's literally your own ego that you need to get over in that moment, because the truth is, yes, like, who are you to get something fucking perfect?
Yes, you, when there's
idiot,
no such thing as,
like,
it.
Probably even the person who's best at it in the world, whatever the
right
thing is,
yeah,
can't do it perfectly.
Yeah.
But you
right
are beating yourself up because you're not the...
But, and the thing is, perfectionism is an idea.
Yeah.
It's an abstract concept. It's not a living, breathing thing. So, I mean... You look at nature and it's, you know, it's doing what it does. It's imperfect in every moment, and yet it's perfectly doing what it's doing imperfectly. Yeah. And
if it's on CNN.
It's on CNN, real. Right, exactly. That was, you know what?
Back then.
The only time I've ever thought
actually.
Let me just preface that.
That's how bad times were.
That's how
bad times were.
I was willing to trust CNN. I ended up going on the internet, and there it was on, like, you know, Entertainment Tonight website,
right,
or something. Once again, it was like, oh, fuck. And so I immediately knew this is going to be a whole nother beast.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's this very personal, private grief, and then there's this other thing that's happening. And people started, I mean, I've heard it, I've been hearing it for the last 7 years. People say to me, I never cried before when a celebrity died, but I cried when your dad died. You know, so, and these are mostly a lot of cynical fucking people.
Right.
Who are my dad's fans,
yeah,
you know. These are a lot of no bullshit type people who don't cry at much of anything. So I'm like,
right,
oh shit, they're crying? Fascinating. You know, it's not like, you know, when John, you know, like a Beatle got shot or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is fair. I cried when John Lennon died. But
yeah. No, they're George Carlin fans. They're like, I cried when I came out for 15 seconds and then I grew up,
right,
and I was cynical about everything.
Yeah, exactly. And
I said, who's this clown cutting the cord?
Yeah.
And then I was.
And I'm done.
And then I'm like,
never again.
Never again.
Never again. But, and I really realized, all that's happened to me the last 7 years, which has been that's a whole nother frickin' lifetime. But that with this book being done and kind of my public George Carlin daughter's life, I feel like there's been an arc to it these last 7 years. Yes, I'll always be my dad's daughter and stuff, but I don't really need to talk about it anymore. There it is. It's in the book. Just go whatever you want. There it is. That I'm getting now time to personally grieve my dad finally, that I didn't really have a lot of space to do that. I felt on display. I chose to be his voice and face in the world,
uh-huh,
because his legacy is so important to me.
So that's interesting to me, because it's not something that you really delve into in the book, although it's like, if you're reading between the lines, you know,
yeah,
it's there throughout the book.
Yeah.
But that's... It feels like a choice in that moment when you're talking about it. It felt like you literally made a choice rather than, like, you know, like often we make choices in life, but it's a series of small choices that,
yeah,
lead us to something. You go, oh yeah, okay, I guess this is the choice I made.
Yeah.
But it felt to me a bit different to that. Am I wrong, or is that what happened?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was a choice. I mean, it's like, well, I could either disappear.
Yeah.
And,
which would have been fine. Like, no one had any expectation that you would do anything.
Absolutely would have been fine.
Yeah.
And yet I had a feeling that for whatever reason in my own personal growth or, you know, whatever this path life thing is, that it was important for me to walk through this instead of around it. And this was the conversation that I ended up having 2 years after his death with Provenza. Provenza said to me, you know, because I had done a version of my show. I told some stories and played some videos of my dad's thing on a cruise ship with Lewis Black, and right. That's how it all started. It all started with Lewis going, come on the cruise ship. We want to have fun. I need a day event.
Right.
Tell some family stories, play some videos. And you and Bob, my husband, have 8 days with me and Kathleen and Larry Wilmer. It was just an incredible opportunity to be on a cruise ship with these guys, party, have fun. But I came home and people kept saying, oh, this is amazing. You should do this. And I was like, the last fucking thing I want to do with my life is get on a stage and be George Carlin's daughter and tell stories about my dad and everything like that. But Paul and I sat one night and Paul said to me, you know, this could be a really beautiful, brilliant piece of art, you know, as only Paul can say, as people out there know Mr. Provenza.
Yeah.
And
he's a man with a lot of ideas.
He's a man with a lot of ideas and a lot of soul and a lot of heart and a lot of depth.
Yeah.
And I knew there was something here as an artist and as a human that if I, and I knew, and I had already decided to be there for my dad's legacy, you know, and Paul said, you know, you could avoid all of this. And I said, yes, but you never avoid it. You know, I could pretend that I'm not him and never talk about him and all that kind of stuff and do it that way. But there was something about me going through it. I think because of my enmeshment, my background, all of that stuff, my only childhoodness, that I knew that if I walked through it as consciously as possible, staying grounded as much as I could, that at the end of it, I would be freer than if I pretended I was free at the beginning of it.
I mean, I absolutely think that's right. And like, I mean, if you think of it, like, I mean, it gives us, just to use today as an example of that, like it gives me the freedom to have a conversation with you that is about, you know, kind of the concept of these things.
Yes.
And, you know, comfort in that sort of thing, going, hey, if anyone wants to know, like, you know, what Kelly's story and what her thoughts on all this is,
right,
go and buy the book.
Yeah.
It's really great.
Exactly.
I read it in one day. Like, you know what I mean? But it's all in there.
It's a page-turner. It really is.
You know, and so you can, absolutely, you can kind of go, well, that's there.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't need to go over that. We can, you know, talk about.
Yeah, and for me, you know, 15 years ago when I, as you, because you've read the book, I did this one, I did my first solo show and ended up putting it on the shelf and ended up going to grad school instead. This in some ways been a 15-year arc for me as an artist and as a human wanting to share this survivor story. So for me, it's like right now, I'm in this really beautiful, strange place because I've fulfilled a dream, first of all, an artistic dream, which is, oh my God, how many people on the planet get to do that? And B, I get to be in this interesting place of now what? Like the last 15 years, this story, even when I put it on the shelf, has always been on the shelf. It's always been tapping at me like, you know, I'm still here. You know, you still want to tell the story. You know, you still have a story to tell. And now that it's done, it's like, oh, there's a, I can feel like this armor coming off of my body and be like, oh, okay, what's the real fucking conversation I want to be having now? Which is partly the conversation you and I get to have here today.
I've refined my analogy. I didn't quite get it right when we went with it earlier, but now that you've said that, I feel like I get it a little bit more, which is when I talked about the foundations of your house. Here's what I think is the better analogy, is that idea of like, you know, you need to get something repaired.
Mm-hmm.
We all need to get something repaired.
Yep.
You can cover it up for as long as you want, but at some stage you need to repair it. Now, when you are getting it repaired, you can choose just to repair that, or you can choose to like add an extra, you know, story to your house at the same time. You know, we'll get the renovations done and we'll, you know, also get blah, blah, blah and move forward.
You need that master suite bathroom.
I have to mourn my dad anyway. I'm going to have these conversations.
Yes.
And also here's a way that I can move forward in my life and create something and make something. It's interesting.
And have a ripple effect. I mean, no matter what, you want to have an impact.
That one is from February 2016, Will Anderson with Kelly Carlin there. You can hear the whole thing at tofop.com if you'd like to hear more. Over now to Lauren Freed. Lauren was one of the earliest guests on the podcast. This one goes all the way back to 2014. And Lauren is a business advisor, marketing strategist. You may have seen her on the panel with Will on Gruen. And she speaks about her philosophy in this chat with Will.
I'm terrible. I don't know what this podcast is, and I really haven't thought about it. Mm-hmm. Because there's part of me that's like, I need it to just find out what it is. Like, you know, I'm happy for it to just find out what it is. But that means that sometimes early on, I'm really like, I don't know, when should I? Anyway, people don't need to hear this. I haven't done it for a while, and now I'm just telling them what's wrong with it. So,
We're warming up.
Do you have a philosophy, do you think?
I do. I have I have a real life vision for myself. Mm-hmm. And funnily enough, it took me years to come up with it, and now I just accidentally live by it. Okay. Just because that made it real.
Yep.
But the one that I've been talking about a lot lately is, don't make decisions at altitude.
What does that mean?
So on planes, you make decisions you shouldn't.
Oh, my God.
You've been on a lot of planes. I'm not sure if you know what I'm talking about. Like, The Notebook is sad, but on a plane.
Oh, it's so sad. Oh, it's there is something about being up there that, like.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. I've cried at films that I should not be crying at on a plane.
Yeah. And there's people walking past you and you're crying and they don't know what's happening. But so notice,
yeah, right. They're just walking by me going, but you don't understand, they're robots in disguise. Oh, hang on, why is he crying at Transformers? We must be very high.
Frozen's very sad. Yeah. I watched it the other day.
Oh my God.
Happy ending, but sad bits.
Yeah.
But
spoilers.
If
anyone who was going to that children's movie thinking there was going to be a terrible ending. That's an amazing marketing success story. I was reading in the paper just yesterday about how Frozen's now become the number one, you know, it's the number one animated film, I think, of all time now.
Wow.
But they've run out. The big problem now, it's rare in marketing, particularly with a big thing like Disney, mm-hmm. where this is ever a problem. They can't get merchandise out quick enough to satisfy the demand for merchandise.
Jeez.
Like, you know, parents, there's so much demand for Frozen stuff that Disney just publicly said, we just did not understand how big this thing was going to be.
Wow.
Like they said, it's not a movie anymore. It's a franchise. And I'm like, now you've ruined it.
Yeah. Great. But all my friends that have seen it about 20 times. Like, their kids are obsessed. It's like a childhood addiction.
Yeah. No, I must admit, when I hung out with my sister and her kids, they were all belting out some Frozen, and I went, okay, this is a thing.
It's sticky.
Maybe I'm going to have to go, I'll have to watch it on a plane. But that's a really good idea, because you're right. Like, but now, do you mean genuinely, like, at altitude, or do you mean that as a more, like, a metaphor, a broad sort of analogy for other aspects of decision making?
I find that on the plane at altitude, I make decisions, big decisions, life decisions, whether I'm, you know, I've actually had breakups on planes. Uh-huh. Like, who would have thought?
Like when the other person's there? Or
yeah, no, they're there. Yeah,
do they need to be there? No.
It's usually important with both.
I mean, it's a great place to break up too, because then you're trapped next to them for the rest of it.
Yeah. I've done one on the way home from Europe.
Oh, that's how far into the trip?
Oh, first sector.
Oh,
is a long way.
I mean, surely you've got to like at least save that for the stopover. even if you knew it was going to happen, surely you've got to be nice to each other until the stopover.
Well, I had no control, right? You just can't wait. No patience. But I make big decisions, and travel for me is really, that is just enlightening. So I have to usually get a plane to get to the place I want to go to.
Right.
Then when I'm there, and I love to travel by myself, I just live in another world that's not reality, and therefore I just see things really differently. I have different experiences that life gets a bit busy when I'm at home, but when I'm away, sometimes I just don't even know where my phone is for a couple of days. Like,
right.
I'm just totally a different person.
And that's really interesting, isn't it? Because that is a completely different person to the person that you are in the real world.
Yeah. And it's not an escape from my reality, but it's just I take those experiences and I come back and I'm just a little bit, there's something different about me.
When did you first travel? Where did it come from?
Well, my dad's a pilot, so we traveled a lot when we were kids, but we did a lot of America and Asia. But I guess the last few years, my interest has been peaked around different places. I'm working my way through the seven wonders of the world, and I'm
Well, tell me that so far. So what are the seven? Well, what have you been to out of the seven? I assume there's seven of them.
There from are. The name. I know. It's leaving.
They don't have like a bonus wonder now with eight wonders. Right. Now if you pay for all seven, get nine wonders.
Yeah.
Two extra wonders for free.
Yep. Yeah. 10% more.
Right, yeah.
So I did Cairo and Petra. The Colosseum's on some of the lists, and I just did the Colosseum.
Oh, wow. How's this? I went to Rome and I drove past the Colosseum and didn't go in.
Well,
Does that count as doing it?
Did not go in. No, I don't think so.
Drove past.
Inside's pretty important.
Yeah.
Didn't
go to the Vatican City either.
No.
I ate a lot of pizza and drank a lot of wine, though.
Yeah, me too, but I still managed to get to the Colosseum, the Vatican.
I don't like lining up.
I was just in the Colosseum, the Vatican a couple of weeks ago, and my Italian tour guide, I thought maybe he was putting it on a bit. Because he was just going, Lorena, I'm going to take you through the Vatican. And putting the A's on everything.
Yeah, it was Mark Mitchell, con the fruit. I think it was Greek, by the way. In that, so that's horribly racist.
But he was, and he just said to me, it's Italian. Yes, I know, same thing. I went, okay, so every barrier in the Vatican, he just opened up and we just walked through.
Oh, yeah,
so
right.
So we had like the back tour.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. That's good.
So it's very cool.
Yeah,
so
that is actually good. I mean, don't get me wrong, I would have liked to go. I just don't like lining up for stuff.
No, that's why you get a tour guide.
Yeah.
That's Italian, because they just push it.
Yeah, I'm definitely like one of those front of the line people.
Me too.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm just, yeah.
Or not go. I'm certainly never a person who, I'm not happy to, I don't want to push in front of anybody. If there's some thing where I can buy front of the line, that's what I'll do. I love that. Like if I'm going to an amusement park or whatever and there's a front of the line pass, that's what I'll do. Mm-hmm. But I don't want special treatment. I want the appropriate,
Those ones at Disneyland, where you go and you get your ticket and then you go away for 45 minutes and come back?
Yeah.
I'm good with that.
Yeah.
And they call it an express pass. It's it's not really.
It's not really. No, it's just more appointments. All.
That's right. Fun by appointment.
It's a personal assistant. Essentially, you don't get an express pass at all. You get Google Update or something. That's what you get. All right. So traveling alone is interesting to me.
Yeah.
So tell me what it is about traveling alone. Oh, no. So you were telling me about what you've seen so far.
Okay. So I did, I did Cairo, Petra, Colosseum, and I'm going to aim to get to the Great Wall this year.
Uh-huh.
Tried to get the Taj Mahal recently, but takes a bit of time to get a visa.
Yeah, right.
So I didn't get there. So probably Taj Mahal next year, Rio de Janeiro. I think that's every one of them.
Okay. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Why was it that – why that? Why did you choose that for a start, on your little mission of things you're going to do? Why that? I've always had a dream, by the way, of watching test match cricket.
I've never had that dream.
No. A lot of people haven't had that dream, right? Yeah. It's hardly Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, this one. I have a dream. And the weird thing about this dream is that it's very achievable and I've done not much to, pursue it.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to watch test match cricket in all the places they play test match cricket. It's not that many places. It's there's I would have to go to – I've already seen it in Australia and England.
Tick,
right?
Yep.
New Zealand would be very easy for me to do.
Yeah.
South Africa would be reasonably easy. The West Indies. Zimbabwe, that can get a little tricky.
Touch and go.
Pakistan and India, depending on, what time. But, there's not that many places in the world that – but I've done nothing towards doing it. So I'm interested in the fact that you not only have said that you would like to do this thing, because a lot of people say that they would like to do things. So I'd like to go and visit, the seven wonders of the world.
Yeah.
But not many people then just go, all right, what are they, and start checking them off.
Yeah. About 2.5 years ago, I lived in Paris for a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
I lived by myself and I spent a lot of time by myself.
Yeah.
So you have every meal alone. You walk the streets and do things every day by yourself.
Yeah.
And that's the first time I've actually really been by myself. I would have hated to get to a restaurant early and have to wait for someone. I'd be embarrassed thinking everyone was looking at me.
I think that's really interesting because a lot of people find the idea of eating by yourself terrifying or going to the movies by yourself terrifying. But as someone who spent my life traveling the world mostly by myself, most of my meals are by myself. And most of the times I go to the movies, it's by myself. And I spend most of my day by myself. So it's interesting that transition between those two things. Did you find it difficult at first or did you embrace it straight away?
Well, I kind of had no choice, so I just did it.
Yeah.
And I just started doing a journal. So I write in a journal and I wrote in a journal every day when I was away.
How much would you write?
Some days I'd write 4 or 5 pages. Other days, I could write 30 or 40.
And would you write as you go or would you, the sort of thing where you'd carry it around and you just when you had a thought, you would write stuff down?
I also did it around meals or if I was sitting down because I reckon something with me is I'm really curious. And if anyone ever read my journal, I would die. But if they did, there's so many areas where I go, I wonder, and I'm constantly going, I wonder why, I wonder this, about myself, about other people, about locations. And I really love that. And I try when I go out not to touch my technology.
Mm-hmm.
So every Tuesday night, I go out on date night with myself. So anywhere in the world, but in Sydney consistently, I go out every Tuesday night for dinner by myself. Same restaurant, love it, sit there by myself, write in my journal. And I'm usually there first and leave last. Like, it's not like I'm just eating. Like, I'm actually having a night out.
Right, yeah. I mean, well, in that way you can kind of take your time.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, there is no rush. You're not on it. You know, you can just go, oh, yeah, I'll start with a glass of wine and then I'm going to get something else and I'm going to fiddle around here. No, I understand that. So in your – when you say you're curious, you wonder, where did that come from? Like, when you were young, did you have that – like, do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, an older brother, older sister.
Okay, so you're the youngest. So were you curious as a kid, do you think?
I don't reckon I was. Funnily enough, we just watched a lot of our videos from when we were kids, and I was pretty cute, actually. I was told I was naughty, but I think I was just it was just cuteness overload, and they didn't know what to do with it. Yeah, but I think that only the last few years have I actually gone, life is ticking, Lauren. Like, I looked at the last year and sort of in March this year, I went, wow, a year has passed. Uh-huh. And that's one unit of time. Now, I might only have 40 more units of time and I'm dead.
Right. So if you're lucky.
Yeah, yeah. If I do everything right.
Right.
I'm thinking, I really can't waste time. And then I'm very focused on goal setting. But personally, I know that I want to have a lifestyle filled with experience or a life filled with experience and really deep relationships and friendships and doing it all with humility. And I know that. And I go, great, I know that now. Seven Wonders, fuck, wouldn't that be amazing?
Right.
And I don't want to be all talk. There's been years where I'm just all talk and I don't want to do that. I actually want to be able to look back at the end of every year or at the end of my life and go, wow.
Well, that's an interesting thought. There's a couple of things there that I'd like to talk about. The first one is that you seem to have these like key principles about how you see yourself now.
Yeah.
So the first thing is like, where did they come from? Like, how did you kind of decide on those? Mm-hmm. And secondly, the bigger question is, how did you change from somebody who talked about those sort of things into somebody who actually did those things?
I think that there was a real change in my life a few years ago, and I went, I'm in this numb state. Like, I heard a speaker speak and they talked about confusing pleasure with happiness recently. And it made so much sense to me because I was kind of a little bit numb to life. I had a smaller scope of emotion. Like, the bad was all right. I just box it up and move on. The good was good, but, you know, okay, of course I got good.
Yeah.
So now I have this much, much wider scope of emotion. So the bad means hysterically crying and the good means I just go, can my life get any better than it is right now? And I wanted that because that numb state was really frustrating for me.
The willingness, you have to kind of be willing to fail to succeed sort of thing.
That's right.
And you've got to be willing to be sad to be happy.
Yeah, and I
because
just
one's kind of they're not the opposite of each other, by the way. There is it's a myriad of complicated things, but you have if you're not allowing yourself one, I always say this about criticism and stuff like that, or like people when they read stuff on the internet. I said if you believe the good stuff, then you're going to have to believe the bad stuff.
Yeah.
If you don't believe the bad stuff, don't believe the good stuff. You'll be fine. Like there's a bit in between. Sometimes you know you've got to save that for your real life, but you can be too. Sorry, that was the point. The whole thing was you can get too closed off. You can start to go, well, I won't feel sad when I'm sad and I won't feel happy when I'm happy because I've just left myself in this kind of safe tunnel.
Absolutely. And it's sort of like day and night. It's going to happen. Yeah. And so you can just roll with it and go, oh, yeah, daytime, oh, nighttime. And I was like, no, I want to have a full life.
Uh-huh.
And I was single and I thought, well, I don't need to ask anyone, do you feel like going to Cairo?
Yeah.
Can we squeeze Petra in somewhere?
Yeah.
It was just like, you know what? I've got 3 days. I'm going to Cairo. I was actually coming home from Paris and I went, I've got 3 days, I'm going to Cairo.
Right.
And I landed and I was on, like, literally from when I made the decision to when I was on a camel going past the Great Pyramids of Giza, I was going, wow, it's not even 24 hours.
Right.
You know, you don't have to, seriously, it wasn't even 24 hours. Right. I went, okay, here I am.
From high altitude on a camel. Decision to camel.
Yeah.
About 24 hours.
I must have been sitting on a mountain when I made that decision. Yeah.
All right. So, would you say then that, I mean, because you mentioned the fact that you were single, was it sometimes those sort of life moments where you go from one thing to another, you transition from a relationship to not a relationship or to like a job to another job or those sort of things can be the moments where you have an opportunity to reposition your life? Is that?
Yeah, it's definitely for me. I've always been in a relationship. Like I met my first boyfriend at 16 and then carried relationships the whole way through.
Yep.
And so when I wasn't in one, I went, and I'm sitting in Paris writing in a journal going, who do I want to be? What do I want my life to be?
Yep.
It was very amazing. I was like, no excuses, Lauren. you can do anything you want, anything. So if you don't, there's no one else to blame now. It's just you.
And how much of, because this is an idea that is interesting to me, you know, and like, I mean, I think of it a little bit like you do. Like, I mean, I just turned 40 and look, you know, chances are the way that I've lived my life, if I get another 20 years, I'll probably be pretty happy. If I get another 30, maybe the last 10 won't be that flash. Yes. So, yep. So I do think a lot about that idea of not only – like, and it was very nice what you said about pleasure and happiness, because I think so often that we don't give ourselves permission to ask ourselves, or we are too afraid to ask ourselves, what really makes me happy? Mm-hmm. Not what should I do that other people think should make me happy? Because I'm – and, you know, I won't go into it, but I've made a couple of career choices this year that no one else can really understand. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone else is kind of like, but you've got this thing and it's successful. And I understand that. And other people's lives also rely on me making those decisions. So I don't take those decisions lightly. Sometimes I think you make those decisions because you care too much about – you go, well, everyone else thinks I should be doing this. Maybe I should be doing this. Whereas I got to a point where I was like, well, you know what, at least for a year I need to kind of see if – I can just do what makes me happy. And the biggest revelation was the other day when I was just pottering around, you know, the house after being on the road for 3 months, like had not had a night off in 3 months. It was my first, in fact, nearly 4 months without one single break where there wasn't travel or shows. And I just was really happy. Like I was just really happy. I should have been like tired or sick or like whatever, but I wasn't. I was just like, I'm happy. Like I'm really enjoying myself. I'm sorry to everybody else who relies on
me. I had one
probably,
day off. I saw it was just
probably
the one.
Would not be liking this conversation. But I think that a lot of people, you know, they think, oh, well, everyone else is working harder, so I have to work harder, when maybe they're the sort of person who is going, yeah, you know what? I'd actually prefer 2 more hours with my kids a day. Or I'd preferred, you know what? Gary in the office can work 7 days, but I like playing golf. Mm-hmm. And as long as I work hard enough that I can still play golf on the weekend – or that can be a myriad of other things, like, you know, that you have other dreams or aspirations or mm-hmm. things that you want to do with your life. But I think so often we don't give ourselves permission to ask ourselves, what genuinely makes me happy? And, you know, what world do I want? Do I want kids? Do I want to be married? What sort of relationship do I want to have? Do I want to have a relationship? You know, all those various things.
And you live in a bit of a different space to me as well, who lives in a different space to someone who's employed in a business where there probably is a little bit more choice around all of that stuff.
Sure.
And over Christmas, I read the 4-Hour Work Week. Uh-huh. And, well, I didn't read it. I listened to it, which went for 12 hours, which would be 3 weeks,
really,
if I went by his philosophy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I listened to it.
That was 3 weeks of work for him.
Yeah, that's how he did
it. He said, yeah, it's going to take 12 hours. I can only do it over three weeks.
Yeah.
Have you
I'll
not read the
month.
Title?
But I'd love just a 4-hour work day.
Yeah.
But he talks very much about, well, the things I've read it before, but what resonated this time was freedom of location, freedom of, like, looking at your life as semi-retired.
Right.
If you want to go and do a mountain bike ride around Mont Blanc, why would you wait till you're retired at 65? You can't do it then.
Yeah.
You're not physically capable. You might have shitloads of cash, but you can't do the mountain bike tour you want to do. So he's like, just make the time, work out what your life, work backwards, retrofit it back, going, I want to live in this house and retire like this, and work it backwards, and you might find you only have to make $300 a day.
Right.
But instead, we're so hungry for wealth and creation of something that we don't even know what size it needs to be. We just go more, 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 greed, greed, more, more. And so therefore, we all work 5 or 6 days a week. We all take 4 weeks holidays a year because that's what society's told us to do.
Right.
But his book was really great for me. It was like, well, what's the end game look like? Work backwards.
Thank you very much to Lauren Freed, tofop.com, for the whole chat with Will. Let's finish things up today with Phil McDonald. A bit of a different chat here. Phil is Will's next door neighbor who he met over the fence, and they had a fantastic chat. Turns out Phil is quite an interesting fellow, and he talks about his philosophy here. Enjoy this chat with Phil McDonald.
Today, you may or may not know who our next guest is, but this is how the podcast starts anyway. I say guest, who are you?
Phil McDonald.
Now, Phil, how do we know each other?
Next door neighbours.
We are. Yeah. I have just moved into a new house in Melbourne and Phil is my next door neighbour, immediate next door. Definitely number one in the friendliest of people in the neighbourhood.
Thank you. I like that.
Made himself known very early on. You've come over and trimmed our communal hedge for me already, which...
I knocked on your front door first and to see what you're like, and yeah, you're a nice guy, so I thought I'd cut your hedge then.
Now, Phil, the reason that I've got you on the podcast is we were having a chat out the back the other day, and I discovered something absolutely amazing about you, and I wanted to get you on the podcast to talk about that, but... As we've chatted more and more, I feel like this tale is going to become more and more interesting because the more I'm learning, the more that I feel like there's a whole bunch of things that I don't quite know. So, Phil, the way that I normally start this podcast is I ask people if they have a philosophy towards something. It can be towards work, life, love, anything, a motto of some kind, a way that, you know, a philosophy through which people sort of live their life. And you strike me as a man who might have one or two, I think.
Well, I have got lots of things in mind, but I haven't really put anything together. But I thought, I went for an 18K walk this morning, and I thought, I'm seeing Will later on, I've got to get something here. So this is a little bit of a brief of what I think and what my philosophy, and you've got your philosophy. I, Phil, have got my philosophy, so how about that?
I don't like that you're coming in with all this good branding, Phil.
But... explore the unknown, risk failure and fame, share your energy and friendship, because nothing stays the same.
Oh, Phil, I love it. Good job. Well, so that's what an 18K walk will do. It'll clear the mind, give you an opportunity to think about something.
Yeah.
Well, let's start talking about why you were... on an 18K walk this morning, because that'll get us into what started me thinking about this conversation, and then we can go more broadly. But let's talk about that first. Why did you go for an 18K walk this morning, Phil?
Well, I have in 2 weeks' time, on the 6th of May, I'm leaving Royal Park, Melbourne, and walking from Royal Park right up to Corumba in northern Queensland, following the Burke and Wills route. And so... I thought I better start doing some training. So I did a 10K walk yesterday and an 18K today. I'll probably do a 35 or something and probably Wednesday or something like that. And another maybe creep up to 40. And then I should be primed. Then I'll give myself 3 or 4 days rest. And then May the 6th, I head off on 3,200-kilometer trek.
Now, firstly, I think that's more training than Burke and Wills put into it. So I think so, yeah. I think that's the good news. And you did tell me happily that you're not going to try to come back as well. That's the mistake they made.
They did do the complete crossing of Australia. And why they were doing it, of course, is to see if they could get the communication lines across and right through Asia and so on. But John McDougall Stewart... He had left Adelaide going up the centre, which is going up through Alice Springs and so on, which wasn't there then, but he was finding a route up there. And Burke and Wills, Victoria, were wanting to beat South Australia. So while Burke and Wills are going up there, they were racing John McDougall Stewart, but they didn't know that John McDougall Stewart had come back. So they were going in ridiculous... time of the year, they left Melbourne on the 20th of August, then they left Cooper Creek on the 16th of December. You can imagine how hot it would be up at Cooper's Creek on the 16th of December. And they're going further north, right up to the top of Australia, and that's going to be thunder and lightning, it's going to be torrential rain, it's going to be humidity. It's just the wrong time to be there. So they should have just given up then. But as you said, yes, they came back and, of course, they died at Cooper's Creek and they'd already achieved what they wanted to do is cross Australia. So I'm not going to come back.
What made you fascinated in doing this particular walk? What was take me back to why you decided that you were going to do this in the first place.
Yeah, I was 15-year-old, I wasn't a book reader, but I found this book on Cooper's Creek by Alan Moorhead and Burke and Wills, you know, Crossing Australia. And it fascinated me, and I thought, wow, that's real adventure. Unfortunately, it was a tragic adventure, but it was something, and it just, I thought, I've got to see that place. So when I got a license when I was 18, probably a year later, I went up to Cooper's Creek, I went to Innamincka and Birdsville and all of these places, and I nearly lost my life as well because I got stuck on the Birdsville track without any, and that was in the middle of summer. But, yeah, so that's sort of how I got involved, and I thought, I love Australia, and I've been around Australia quite a few times for different reasons, and then I retired from running a bicycle business 2 years ago, and I had a coronary blockage, and I had to go and had a stent put in my coronary artery, and I did rehab, and the nurse said to me, she said, look, you've got to do walking. You've got to walk every day. And I walked out of that hospital and I thought, walk every day. You know, I thought, what can I do, you know? I thought, well, maybe I'll do the Burke and Wills track. So I asked
she was probably thinking just, you know, take the dog for a couple of laps around the block, Phil, I think.
Well, that's what it was supposed to be, but I'm a little bit eccentric, I suppose. And I thought, well, yeah, I could do that. So I had to come home with my towel between my legs and said to Susan, I said, hey, Suze, I'm thinking of, you know, I've been told to walk every day, so I was thinking of walking the Burke and Wills track. And
how did that conversation go? Was she, because she's going with you, of course. She's well, of your course, support.
She's my support.
Yes.
I can't go unless Susan supports me right. And drives the car. We've got to have the car. She doesn't really want to be towing caravans and trailers and all that sort of thing, and neither do I. And so we've got the Land Cruiser, and we sleep in the car. We eat outside the car, we've got a little awning, and and we set ourselves up there, and it's not much good setting up too comfortably because we're moving every day, and you know, I'll be averaging 30 k's a day, but some days 35, some days 40, some days 20, but it's an average of 30 k, and Susan is a very, very important part of that expedition.
When you're walking, are you just walking? I'm interested in this because I walk a lot, but I'm a big listener to things. Like, you know, that's where I catch up on my world. You know, I listen to a lot of radio shows and podcasts and stuff, and I tend to get that done as I go about. But what do you do? What's your, are you listening to music? Are you in your own thoughts? Are you walking without someone in your ear? Like, what's your kind of method to get into the zone?
Yes, it is music. I love music. My dad was a great pianist. My sister's a pianist. I love singing. I love music. So I do listen to a lot of music. And I'm going to listen to Will Anderson's podcast from now on. Because that will pass a lot of time and very interesting.
So when you're struggling through that, I'm interested in this. Like when you hit moments within these things, and I'm sure there's going to be, you know, you have to prepare yourself for the fact that on this walk, you're going to have some tough times as well as some, you know, good times. How do you prepare yourself for that, you know, mentally prepare yourself for that?
I think I've done it all my life, you know, because as you say, it is mentally, you have to be mental to do it. And really, you've got to, you know, your brain, sometimes your legs get sore or you get a, just a couple of weeks ago when I was doing some walks, I had a sore foot. And I pushed through that for about a kilometre and I was nearly going to have to stop. But somehow it goes away. And I think a lot of it is to do with your brain. And I've pushed my body all the time and I always push that bit further. And so mentally I think I'm quite strong. And by the way, I was talking about giving up cigarettes and the next one was going to be up in Kosciuszko. When I got to the Kosciuszko, getting off the subject a bit, but Susan pulled out the smokes. And here we got photos of me, but they were lolly smokes, you know. So I never had a smoke again after that, anyway. But so mental, you have to be mental and really push through the barriers, and I've trained myself all the time for that.
I mean, it's an amazing connection that you seem to have between. It seems to be not only about the challenge itself, but its connection to a story. Like that, what that's what seems to keep coming up with me. It's like, yeah. you know, I learnt this fact about this, or I, you know, I heard this story about this person, or I read this story about this person and what they did, and then I had this idea that I would do this other thing, which I think is such a lovely way to be not only learning about the place where you live, but then sort of, I guess, practically involving yourself in. I mean, it's one thing to know the story of Burke and Wills, but another thing to be able to say, oh, yeah, I walked that.
Yeah,
you know what they walked? I walked it as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an amazing leap of... What is it that, other than the fact that it's something that you've always done, what is it that still drives you to want to do things like this, I guess, is the question.
I suppose I want to extend my life as long as possible and push the boundaries. And, you know, at my age now... I think that I've still got it in me. I'll find out. I'll find out when I get out on that road. And
is there fears that, I mean, you think you've still got it in it. Is there fears from anyone around you who goes, Phil, you're 72.
You're looking a little bit deaf.
No, I'm not saying. I'm just asking the question, yeah, Phil. There must be some friends and family, or are they all just like, oh, no, that's Phil. This is what
I am really amazed that nobody has ever doubted me.
Right.
And I'm amazed at that. And in doing the bicycle tours all around Australia and different places, we go to so many motels and we say, can we book 20 rooms or 30 rooms? And very, very few people ever question that. You know, they say, yeah, sure, you know, you can book 30 rooms and we don't put a deposit down. And it's the same I've said. I don't tell a whole lot of people what I'm doing, but... really, nobody has said you're joking or get real, you know. They sort of, they probably, in their brain, they probably say idiot, dickhead or whatever. But no, it's surprising that very few people show any doubt. And I have a lot of, praise for the people. They just accept people for who they are and go out and do it if you want to.
I mean, that is the, you know, the amazing message at the heart of it, isn't it? That you can actually just do these things.
Yeah.
You can dream something and then decide you are going to do it. Now, something that you mentioned to me just in passing before we started recording, which is a whole other one, was you said it reminded of you when you rode a penny farthing around Australia, and you just dropped that as if that was just an incidental little part of this story. But I feel like, Phil, that's something that we should be exploring a little bit more. So hang on. What did you do? Am I right? You rode a penny farthing around Australia?
In 1988, in the bicentennial year. Have you got any time? I can tell you.
We've got time. Tell me, please. You live next door, mate. It's fine. You're not in a rush to get home.
Well, it was actually it was in the local paper. I lived at Lilydale and I saw a penny farthing advertised for sale in a clearing sale. And I thought, and I had a big 130-year-old home up there and with a veranda all the way around. And I thought, I'll buy this penny and put it on the veranda. It'll be good fun, you know. And so I went to the auction and here's this old penny. And I took $300 and I was going to buy a few other things as well. And went to the auction and here's this old penny and a lot of spokes had gone and a few other things were not on it. And anyway, the auction came up. What have we got for the penny? $1,000. Thank you. 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. I came in at 1,600. Somebody went to 1,700. I got it for $1,800, and I thought, "Wow, you know, I've been stooged here because it was all over in a shot."
Yeah.
And the guy that I'd outbid, he came up and said, "I'll give you $1,900 for it." I thought, "Wow, it must be worth its money."
Right. Yeah.
So I said, "No, I'm going to keep it." And he said, "Well, we're starting the penny farthing championships over in Launceston, in Evandale, next year. You know, you'll have to come over." I thought, well, you know, so I got on this bike and I had to have it all fixed up first and got riding it. And that was good fun. We raced over in Tasmania there. And then the guy said, we're going to have a bike ride from Adelaide to Melbourne. And I thought, wow, I would love that. and anyway, I was quite excited about it all. And I found out that they're gradually dropping off. And I thought, well, I'm going to do it on my own.
Right.
So I did it on my own. I rode from Adelaide to Melbourne in 4.5 days. I averaged whatever that is, a couple hundred K a day or something.
What's your top speed you can get to on a penny farthing?
About 45K.
45K.
Mm. It's a fixed wheel.
Yeah.
And there's no brakes. And you've got to be silly, but that's what it is. And so I rode from there. And when I finished, somebody said, I was being interviewed, and they said, what are you going to do next? And I said, well, I could ride around Australia if I wanted to. And then I realized that that was not in 1986. And I realized then that 1988, bicentennial year, wow, I could do that. And so I got in touch with Rotary and I said, you know, I'll raise some money for Rotary. And they said, well, they did doubt me. They said, this is a bit of a joke, you know. But anyway, they even allowed me to put the tail of the penny on the rotary wheel, you know, the rotary wheel.
Yeah.
I was even allowed to, which was quite weird, but they allowed that. I had to go through a bit of... So I used that logo of Rotary with the tail on it. And and I rode right around and raised over $100,000 for Rotary.
So how long did it take you to ride around Australia?
It was 4.5 months and I averaged about 100 Ks a day. Yeah.
And so what was the most challenging thing about that trip? Tell me, because that, I mean, that's a good example in some ways of, because it's about the same time period as what you're about to embark on now. Obviously a very different thing to do, but a similar sort of time period, right? Yeah. So you kind of understand what that takes. And if people think about this, I mean, this is months. If you think about what, you know, anyone listening to this might have done in the last 4 or 5 months, it's a considerable amount of time that you will be embarking on this project. So when you're doing something like that, which is, you know, a third of your year, nearly half of your year, what was the most challenging part of riding the penny farthing around Australia?
Well, it was probably going downhill.
Where was the most dangerous hill that you
well,
went
all
down
up the east coast, yeah. All up the east coast, you've got all the hills, and I'm fairly good at climbing hills. I taught myself to climb hills because you have to. And but you've got one gear and you're standing up, so you're sitting upright, so you can't actually stand up on your bike. You've just got to push. But when you get up, as soon as you get up there, then you're starting to go down and you've got no brakes. It's a fixed wheel. So you've got to try and push back on the pedals. And I used to say to myself all the time, push back, push back, push back, because you really have to concentrate, and you push back, because if it lets go, or you can't hold it back any further, then it will take off, and then you will go very, very fast, so fast that so you've got to crash straight away, because when I bought the bike, by the way, the guy told me that you won't be able to ride it anyway. And I said, how come? And he said, it's too big for you. And I thought, wow, I didn't know they made them any different sizes. So, I'm getting off the track but the seat, it was on spring steel and the backbone went on an angle and the spring steel went out. So you had suspension on your seat. So I took my suspension off and put the seat right onto the backbone. So I've got it right on and a constant vibration, much more so than you'd ever get. And so going down the hills, and so also jumping off then, when you'd be sitting on the seat, you could reach back because your legs were longer and you could get this little peg and then you'd step off the back to get off your bike. So I could never reach that peg. So the only way I could jump off my penny was like jumping off a horse when the pedal was on its lowest point. I would jump off like jumping off a horse, see? And so going down the hills, if the bike got out of control, I can't even get off because I can't jump off like jumping off a horse. So I had some very interesting times going down hills, and I've got to assess it straight away whether I jump off, but I like a challenge, so I would go down them and it might take me 3/4 of an hour, 1/2 an hour to get down a hill because I'm going about 0 mile an hour and I'm holding the bike back. And it uses different muscles as well, you know, than pushing. You're pushing back. And so that was very tough. I suppose that was the toughest and the most dangerous. And one time I was over near Canberra somewhere and I was going down the hill because we went in to see the Prime Minister, who did in front anyway. But I was going down a hill and I'm really concentrating, and it was a long hill, and I was going down, and then And then a semi-trailer blew his horn. You know, good on you, mate. Well, it frightened the hell out of me, and I lost my concentration. And straight away, the bike started taking off. And he's going down the hill slow as well, not going too fast because of downhill. So I'm catching up to the semi again, and I'm going to have to start passing him because I could look down the bottom of the hill, and I guessed, I couldn't see the bottom of it, right. But it went around, but I could see the landscape was leveling out. So I let the bike go. So I'm probably doing 40 or 50 or 60 k's an hour or something. And luckily, I was catching up to the semi. And but anyway, he had sort of sped off a little bit anyway. So I got away with that. But it's pretty scary and very dangerous because if I fall off the penny then, I've smashed my face. And you also got the handlebars right across your lap. So you can't put your legs out. The only place you go on a semi, on a penny, is straight over the front. And you'll hit the... And so what I used to also do sometimes is throw my legs over the handlebars and then let her rip down the hill that I could see the bottom. And then if something did happen, at least I'm off and running at about 60 k's an hour. But it was a safer way than smashing your face on the tarmac.
I mean, another safer way would to not do it. Well, get a bike, buy a safe bike that fitted you ride that around Australia.
It would. And so they've never worked out brakes because if you have it on the back wheel, there's no weight on the back wheel.
Right.
And you're sitting on the right on the top of that wheel because the bike that I've got is just about vertical, so it's a real sort of a racing bike, whereas the forks on other bikes can be leaning back further and they are safer to ride and they're not as vertical. So when I start to go down the hill, I'm really leaning back and holding it back. So, yeah, apart from the hills, and I love the hills anyway, I love the challenge. And of course, you're going. There's traffic all the time going around Australia. And I had a support crew. I had Dennis and Tiny with me, and also another girl named Kay who did a lot of sort of setting up for the Rotary, because I spoke at Rotary clubs all around Australia. And so it was a fantastic thing.
It feels like this spirit of adventure, you know, obviously has been with you a lot of your life. Like, I mean, the stories that I'm hearing from, you know, when you're young to all these adventures, it feels like you have been enticed by the nature of adventure itself. There is a question I always ask in this podcast, and I think it seems more relevant to this one than many of the ones that I've done, which is I always like to ask people about the idea of death and whether they think about death and whether death is something that, you know, worries them or is present in their thoughts or whether it's not something that they think about at all. For someone who pretty much you've just described to me for the last half an hour about 80 ways you could have killed yourself, I'm interested in how you clearly don't have a particular, well, or maybe you do. I'll let you answer the question rather than me trying to answer it. What relationship does all this have to death? Are you not scared of it, or is this all some sort of, you know, big middle finger up at the universe, at the very nature of death, and I'll defy you and live as large as I can? Do you think about death at all? Has it ever been something that has been in your thoughts as you've got embarked on these adventures?
I have certainly thought about death, and it doesn't really frighten me. I put as much into my life as I can, and I'm very cautious in what I do. People think that I'm stupid and silly, but I think that I'm quite safe, and luckily I have been safe. I have had a lot of luck in my life. I'm sure that most people will say that, and I'm not really afraid of death, and I know it's going to come sometime, and I think, well, it's only greed. If you want to live to 70 or 80 or 90, you're being greedy, aren't you? You're sort of, you know, and I'm not thinking about others then, but for yourself, you know, I want to live life and enjoy it as much as I can, and I think I'm still fit enough to do a lot of things, so I push myself, and I don't want to die, but I've got too many beautiful people looking after me and beautiful people in my whole life.
There you go, guys. Tofop.com for any of the chats on today's episodes that you may have missed or any of the chats you've heard in this compilation series. There's one more episode coming out next week, part of the compilation series, and then we'll be launching a few more dedicated episodes after that. Thank you so much to Mike Howell in America for cutting these together, James Fosdyke for the artwork, and to all the guests on today's episode, Kelly Cullen, Phil McDonald, Lauren Freed. It was great hearing from all of you. Thank you so much to you guys for listening. Be sure to follow the Twitter and the Instagram, Willosophy Pod. I think that's it. Like, subscribe, tell a friend, share it, do all of those things. Patreon.com/tofop if you'd like to donate to the show. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. Thank you so much for listening.